on weeknights from 6
on 2FM. Big thanks to Emma and Graham for driving us through the afternoon. It's Tuesday, January 7th, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, Paul Corry and Fergal Brennan are standing by to talk European football, EFL Cup, and does Elon Musk really want to buy Liverpool?
I'd say you'd love that, Marie, wouldn't you, as a Liverpool fan? Elon Musk taking over.
Absolutely not.
In rugby, Neil Chasey will join us as we hear from Leinster's Joe McCarthy and Connacht head coach Pete Wilkins ahead of a big few days for the Irish provinces.
As always, if you want to get in touch, you can send us a text on 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200, or we're on X on at GameOn2FM.
Game On. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Welcome along. I am following the weather forecast very intently, like many people are. We have had no snow where I'm living in Dublin anyway. We've had none. Ruby, I was thinking about you a little bit earlier on because I know on a Tuesday morning that you are in Willie's yard riding out. What's it like?
It was fun this morning. It was funny. It was a different world in Carlow. When I drove from Kildare all the way to about the edge of Carlow town, and all of a sudden it just all went white again. And you know, the roads weren't too bad. Well, it's main roads pretty much as far as Willie's, but it is a different world, Carlow, Kilkenny, and the further south you go. But it's not so much, it's no more difficult to ride horses in the cold than it is the sunshine, but it's all the staff working there, and the colder it gets. So you think about tonight, all the water pots are going to freeze, all the yards will be frozen first thing in the morning, sanding, gritting, trying to get horses out and moving, probably the tractor on the gallop all night, rotivating it. There's those horses that are running at the weekend. There's breaking the forecast for Friday, isn't there, I think? Rain coming towards the weekend. So Sunday's horses will all have to be exercised tomorrow and the day after, but how do you stop an all-weather gallop from freezing? Well, you've got to keep rotivating it all night.
Well, when I say I was thinking about you, I was thinking about you on a horse going around in the snow having a great time. I wasn't thinking about any rotivating or frozen pots or anything like that. So there's a bit more to it then.
It's always been easy to be a jockey involved with horses, but it's the stable staff this time of year. No different to farmers, Marie. Horses, I'm even thinking yesterday, the schools were closed around here and it was lockdown day. But if you're working with animals, there's no such thing as a lockdown day. And the hardship for people, and as hard as it is for people living in houses with animals, because you can imagine every pipe outside is exposed, trying to drag water to cattle, to pigs, to horses. I mean, it's just torturous.
It's just so educational. Paul Corry's with us here as well. Paul, were you a footballer who enjoyed training in the snow?
I was a gloves and snare kind of guy.
I'd say you or I was at home. I'm sick, boss.
It's a bit cold out there.
Fire up the PlayStation.
To be fair, with the clubs that I was at, I was quite fortunate. Obviously, if the pitches were frozen over, you wouldn't be training on the grass. But I guess the majority of clubs within the Premier League and in the Championship at this stage would have a dome facility. Mm-hmm. And a nice all weather within. But yeah, I can assure you I was well wrapped up for those days. And I can tell you, the north of England does get cold. Very, very cold.
Oh, I can testify for that.
Yeah.
It's crazy that it's not that far from obviously Kildare to Carlow and Dublin to Kildare, and there's such a difference in the conditions at the moment. So at the weekend when the snow was falling and we were getting all these pictures, my kids were playing soccer matches in Dublin on Sunday morning, so it's crazy.
They've
been
in
school Monday. Yeah, it is actually amazing. Now, they're raging. They'd love a bit of snow, but
my daughter came home from football training last night and she was blue.
For reason.
Blue with the cold. Hands, ears. I never saw her as quiet.
I can see the dedication, though, of the coaches. Going out on nights like tonight or last night or at the weekend. They're amazing that they'll still put their teams first. So a shout out to all of the coaches who are coaching kids and adults in this freezing weather. Now, I think for any of us that are sitting in, although I do think you'd have to be staying up late, it would be good to have a look at the golf event that is going to be taking place tonight. It is tonight, Ruby, isn't it?
Yeah. It's indoor golf. TGL, is that what it's called?
Well, you could call it that for today anyway. We'll know after tonight what they're calling it when it goes to air.
I think it is. Tomorrow's Golf League, TGL, the technology-driven version of the sport, which Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy are fronting. It just sounds bizarre, but tonight you will have Matt Fitzpatrick, Ricky Fowler and Xander Schauffele playing Shane Lowry, Ludvig Åberg and Wyndham Clark, the New York Golf Club versus the Bay. And it's like it's in a dome. It's what they drive into a screen. First number of shots are played into a screen, and then from 50 yards, it's live golf. It's a 1,500-seater arena, but they play, obviously, their last chip and their putt, they play live. The green rotates or alternates, so it has 30 different shapes. They use 15 for each of these matches, three bunkers on each green. I don't know. The screen is 64 feet by something massive. I don't know. Simulated golf and then live golf.
The size of an NFL pitch, so it's obviously huge where they are. Okay, Ruby, you're a sports purist. What are you thinking?
No. The only rule I do like on it is the 40-second shot clock. I think that would be a good intervention in all of golf. But real golf is real golf. I mean, who's going to get a bad lie into a screen?
So you're not going to be staying up late to watch it tonight then?
I'm afraid not.
Big and all a fan
as I am of Rory McIlroy's and Tiger Woods, this is not for me. Paul, go on.
This was the PGA's response, wasn't it, to live golf at the time?
They're trying to get new eyeballs and I think maybe attract bigger crowds, and like we know now from having younger people at home or being around younger people like yourself, Paul, that they're consuming sport in a very different way. So it's probably an experiment to see if they can get the masses to tune into something.
On, yeah. Like, I'm always skeptical about those screens, though. Sometimes we're up in the driving range now and be driving a 240 to get in the golf course to go 180. It doesn't necessarily translate onto the course.
There's no bad bounce or bad lie on the screen. But I do appreciate that golf live is a pretty average spectator sport. It might make it a better spectator. Golf's a brilliant, brilliant watch on TV. Mm. But when you're there, it's not really as good a watch.
But the thing about it as well, Ruby, is like you need the time to invest in it. So Sunday evenings are great sitting in watching it. But like the rounds are so long, the programmes are so long, and different generations coming through aren't spending a lot of time watching television. They want highlights, they want glamour, they want 5-minute NBA packages, they want instant shots on Twitter. So it is a very different viewing experience, and to capture the and the competition for eyeballs now is so big. I can see why they are experimenting.
You see the likes of Brooks Koepka on DeChambeau online, like on YouTube. He has a massive channel at the moment. He's a huge following, and he's actually taken it, so he's almost creating his own profile and his own presence online as opposed to kind of being a golfer within one of the tours.
It was Bryson that went outside his house every day trying to hit a hole in one, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Hitting it over the house day after day after day, and millions of people watching him. Like, it's obviously not really that hard to entertain people when you think about it.
Well, they're looking for something instant. Like, that's the thing. Like, they're not going to sit in front of the telly for 5 hours, but they'll watch something that's quick.
They'll watch a fella hitting the ball over his house.
But I find what my lads are, that they're watching people watching football. So the Premier League will be on, and then all of a sudden someone will take the remote control and they'll go to YouTube and they're looking at fans watching the game. So they just look at things completely different now.
And golf probably does struggle for a younger audience. Like, would your younger lads watch this?
They might watch this, but they wouldn't sit down and watch golf. Yeah. Unless it was on and there was nothing else for them to do. But they'd swing a golf club at each other now, that'd be about it.
Patience. Patience is what has been lost to a whole generation behind us, Maria.
They
don't know how to be bored.
So it's
that's what my mother used to say to me.
6:10 on a Tuesday, and we are being educational and philosophical, so we might move on. Well, just
what else can you be in this weather?
True. Tom McKibben is on the verge of turning his back on a PGA Tour card to make a surprise switch to join LIV Golf. So this is really garnering the attention of sports people, because it came as such a surprise that that he might make the switch. So McKibben is close to signing with John Rahm's team, Legion X3? How do we pronounce that?
No idea.
Okay. As a replacement for the relegated Kieran Vincent on the tour, which is financially backed by Saudi Arabia. So that's a bit of a...
Yeah, I can see it though. Was he on about taking a... Is it delaying his PGA Tour card for a year to take a year with LIV, is how I read it. Now maybe that's completely untrue, but I don't know. Is it financial security? Possibly.
Well, you can't judge anybody for that anyway, that's for
absolutely
sure.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I just like when they come out and say it, like that's what I'm doing it for.
Yeah.
Ruby, we've got a text in from Frank, and he said 5 horses entered for a Cheltenham Gold Cup says a lot about the appalling state of UK jumps industry.
It does. But unfortunately, if you don't have novice hurdlers, you won't have novice chasers. And if you don't have novice chasers, you won't have open graded horses. It's racing is no different than any other sport, Marie. And if you don't have an under 16 team, you don't have an under 18 team, it's very hard to have a senior team. And that's basically what's washing through in the UK. Now, this year is the first year in a few that I think that the UK actually do have decent novice hurdlers. But it will take them 3 years to wash into being Gold Cup contenders.
Okay, there you go, Frank.
The wheel turns, but it's also could arguably be the first year Ireland is short on novice hurdlers. So you could say, oh, is the wheel starting to turn the other direction?
So explain to me, why is that the case?
It's not the case. I mean, if it's just as easy, Marie, as going out and buying the most expensive horse, well, the wealthiest person would have them all. But it's not. It's about sourcing the right young talent. And it looks like the UK have sourced possibly better talent than the Irish trainers this season as novice hurdlers, but it's a little bit of potluck.
Okay, I didn't, and wasn't really too interested until he said it could be the case here in Ireland. So, okay, we're going to move on now to football. Fergal Brennan is with us on the line as well. How are you, Fergal?
Very good. As cold as you make it out in the northwest, it is freezing here.
It's actually all right in Dublin, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's okay
compared to other places.
Yeah. Oh, what's going on? Fergal, before we move on to really serious matters in the world of football, let's find out if Elon Musk is actually interested in buying Liverpool. What do you know?
This is certainly not a story I was expecting in the last couple of hours. This is relating to an interview that his father did this afternoon with the Times Radio. The rumour's been floating around for a few days, but hadn't really kind of gained any sort of substance until this interview. And his dad kind of gave a bit of an open-ended answer saying that, yeah, there might be the possibility that he would be interested. He kind of cheekily said that he can't say any more because the stock price or the share price might rocket up and that might change the situation. He's also referenced the fact that I think his grandmother was born in Liverpool and they have family connections here and family connections to supporting the club. So it's very pie in the sky at the moment in that sense. Fenway Sports Group, who own Liverpool, have said over the last couple of years that they are open to outside investment, not a sale, not either a minority or a majority sale, but they've effectively opened their doors to somebody coming in and adding to their current investment package. It's a big headline because he's an enormously influential individual, obviously a very controversial figure. There will be fans that will have incredibly strong positions on even just his name being connected with Liverpool Football Club at the moment. Other than that quite unexpected interview with his dad, there's not really a lot to go on. I don't see there being a situation where Liverpool are sold. They're not in a position where they're looking for that. They're not in a position where they're in financial difficulty. But he's an individual that attracts headlines, both good and bad, the latter in the majority, but at the moment it's not really anything to go on.
You, while we're on the topic of social media, I know that you're at the Liverpool press conferences quite regularly. We've seen Mo Salah, who seems to be regularly using social media now to give clues about what direction his future is going on. How's this been received though, just on the ground around Liverpool?
I think it has split fans as time has gone on. I still think both he, Trent and Van Dijk all have a big support base within the fans. There's flags out, the Carragher line, give Mo his dough, flags that have been at Anfield. And a lot of fans are looking at this as a kind of new way of contracts almost being discussed and being quite public. We're used to associating contract extensions with boardrooms and conversations with suits and agents and not really kind of knowing a great deal about it. Salah's attitude towards the situation is very, very different in terms of the way that he looks to position himself, his agent as well. Trent Alexander-Arnold, Virgil van Dijk have been different. Van Dijk has himself said that an offer did come in a couple of months ago that didn't really meet his expectations and didn't really say too much more than that. So I'd say from the fans' perspective, there's still quite a bit of support. The situation with Trent is different because there's a different type of focus on him because he's from Liverpool, he's come through the academy, the connections, the connotations, obviously the Steven Gerrard interview from recently as well. So I still think there's a huge amount of support for the three players in the sense that fans just want them to sign the contracts. They want them to stay. They see how important they are for the team. But there hasn't really been a significant move in any sort of a direction. I don't think any of them are going to leave this month. That's been pretty much confirmed. But I mentioned on Friday, if this rolls on into February, March time, and Liverpool are pushing for the title, then it could become very tricky for everybody involved in this.
Why?
Because I think at the moment, when they're in good form, a lot of things can be ignored, particularly Salah. He's playing out of his skin at the moment. He's arguably the best player in the world at the minute. As time goes on, fans are going to assume that they're leaving, and that support won't vanish and it won't be torn up overnight, but it will start to reduce, because the general view from most of the fans is, if you're going to sign a contract, sign it. We understand that you want to get the best terms and the salary and the length and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think a lot of fans are now moving towards the idea of, you have our support, but we want a decision. And the longer those decisions come from the individual three players or from them as a three together, then I think that support will start to get chiselled away at ever so slightly as the season goes on, regardless of how informed they are.
There's so much going on at the moment in the different clubs with rumours and speculation, and it seems that a lot of clubs need players in different positions. But it looks like the managers are kind of the same at the moment too, and the whole West Ham situation with Julian Lopetegui and Graham Potter, and then potentially Graham Potter with Everton. What direction is this, I guess, both clubs going to go? Are the two of them looking for a new manager? Is Graham Potter going to go to one of them? I know Lopetegui took the training session today at West Ham, but it seems to be all getting very messy.
I think as it stands, the Friedkin group, after coming in to Everton and taking financial control, they've been quite clear on Sean Dyche, certainly between now and the end of the season, over his position. That can, of course, change. There's a lot of very disgruntled Everton fans over the performances and some of Sean Dyche's answers, in press conferences, particularly over the lack of goals and the lack of exciting football. I think the club, particularly under new ownership, are looking at it as, they're confident that Sean Dyche will keep them in the Premier League. That is the big goal. They cannot go into the new stadium next season as a Championship team. That would be an enormous blow, reputation-wise and financially. West Ham is a different situation. I think there was still kind of a split within the fan base over David Moyes leaving at the back end of last season. They understood that he might not be the most exciting manager around, but he'd done more at West Ham than many, many managers had done before. Julian Lopetegui had come in with a fairly mixed record overall, and things have arguably got worse, certainly in terms of results. So if I was to make a prediction on it, I'd be pretty confident that Lopetegui will go before Sean Dyche, and I honestly don't think Sean Dyche will go before the end of the season.
Paul, what about Evan Ferguson? January transfer window, do you think he'll still be a Brighton and Hove Albion player in early February, or could he be on loan somewhere else or even sold?
Yeah, it feels like he needs a loan move. I don't think Brighton would be in the market for selling Evan Ferguson right now. I don't think they'd probably get the money that maybe they would have in the last kind of 6 to 12 months. But I think when you go down through the Premier League table, Ruby, like, if he is to make a loan move, there's no point in going to another Premier League team and sitting on the bench and finding himself in the same situation as he is at the moment. So there's very few clubs that kind of stand out as, you know, potentially needing a centre forward where everyone can actually go in and play games. West Ham is actually one of those teams where you could see a move come to fruition. Mikel Antonio is obviously out after being involved in that car accident. Jared Bowen is out for a sustained period of time. It hasn't really happened for Falkirk, who they brought in from Borussia Dortmund in the summer. So there's potential for Evan to go there. Other clubs, maybe looking at likes of Fulham, maybe.
Are Everton not crying over a striker?
Yes, they are. Does he fit in? Maybe, yeah, Everton's not a bad one. I would have said Everton, West Ham, Fulham. They're kind of three teams that stick out for me where you could potentially see a move coming to fruition. I don't see any real reason for him to go anywhere lower than that, to a Southampton or a Leicester, where maybe he's not going to be fed a huge amount of chances. But yeah, Everton would be a good one. Does he fit into the way Sean Dyche plays? Yeah, he probably does. He's a good presence, good size, can hold the ball up, link play, get in the box. That's the way Sean Dyche likes to play. Probably suits his way of playing. West Ham and other, and then Fulham. But like, even a Fulham, like Muniz and Jimenez have been banging in goals. So maybe there's not too many opportunities. But for Evan, like, wherever it is, Ruby, he's got to get minutes back into his legs. Like, he's missed a huge amount of football. He missed pre-season when the new manager came in. And I always feel like like once you miss that part of the season, you're always playing catch up. And to be fair to João Pedro and Danny Welbeck, they've done very well at Brighton. So it's going to be a big window for him. It's also going to be a big sort of 12 months when you look forward. He's got to get back to playing. His minutes have really been in a green jersey, and you know, hasn't really had any contribution in the Premier League. So what was a brilliant start for his Brighton career has really slowed down, and a move for him would be good if it was to come about.
Fergal, can you see Ruben Amorim clearing out a few players at Old Trafford? Marcus Rashford, Eriksen, Lindelof,
how
Zerski,
many you mean,
Anthony.
Ruby? How many?
Who do you keep?
How many can you get rid of?
I think there's a potential probably for three or four. That the names that you've just mentioned there are on that list of players that are out of contract at the end of the season. So United are in a position where they can say to clubs who might be interested, look, if we're able to strike a deal at a reduced price, anything to kind of get a few quid in, and then obviously remove some pretty big wages off the salary list. So I think alongside Amorim highlighting players that he doesn't see in his plans, I think there'll be a few of them that will be moved on. But from a business perspective, the way that United are trying to run themselves, I think there will be one or two as well to bring in a fee so that they don't get a free transfer kind of flood of players leaving in June, and also to cut the salary bill. The Marcus Rashford situation is very much in flux. I know Amorim brought him back into the squad a couple of weeks ago and then didn't bring him off the bench. I can't quite remember the game, but he's obviously brought him back in, but he's not played since that interview where he said that he was potentially looking for a new challenge away from the club. I think effectively Marcus Rashford's situation is settled now. Might be too difficult to get it done in January. It's always very difficult because you're against the clock from when January starts all the way to the end of the month, and United have got a busy month as well. They've got the FA Cup, they've got the Europa League as well. So possibly not in January, but I think this, I personally think this is the last season we'll see Marcus Rashford at Manchester United.
Kobbie Mainoo has been linked with Chelsea, Paul, and for big wages as well.
I can't see that one happening. I thought he was brilliant on the weekend, and when you think about how well he did when he first got into the Manchester United team, and you know, centre midfield is not an area of the pitch where they're exactly blessed with options. I thought he did brilliant on the weekend alongside Ugarte, and you would imagine, like, when you talk about transfers and you talk about windows, you have to remember at the back of all of this is the profit and sustainability rules. Mm-hmm. Like, some of these clubs are handcuffed with who they can actually bring in, the likes of an Everton, because their wage bill is so big and they're obviously having to comply with these rules. But Mainoo, I just cannot see Manchester United letting him go. Like, surely that is a player that they base their kind of next 2-3 seasons around.
So it's been reported that his agent has had some talks with Chelsea, but there hasn't been any significant progress made. Is he just looking for a better deal? Is that what's going on here, or is he actually looking for a move?
Well, agents be known for doing that, yeah. for feeding stories into the media.
Like, he's trending on Twitter there. There's 8,000 posts about it.
Well, but he would have signed a contract within the last 12 months.
If you
think about when he broke into the Manchester mm-hmm. United first team, maybe he's getting a sniff of what other players are on, he's not entirely happy, or maybe his agent is looking at somebody like Jadon Sancho, who has thrived in that Chelsea environment and maybe feels that getting out of Manchester United would be the right move for him. But it's not something you could see. Like, there's so many players ahead of Kobbie Mainoo who you get out the door before you would even consider letting him go. And like, he's at such a young age, there's so much in his tank with regards to progression. Manchester United can't be getting rid of the good ones. There's plenty of players like Ruby's mentioned there that you would get rid of before it'd be Mainoo.
Fergal, any insight in it?
I'd completely agree with Paul. It'd be a ridiculous decision to let him go, and I think it is just gossip at this stage. He's arguably Manchester United's most valuable player, and I don't think that's an exaggeration given his performance and the lack of performance from some of his teammates. Manchester United cannot afford to lose Mainoo. No chance.
Fergal Brennan, I am just delighted you said that was gossip. Thank God someone is standing up for idle rumour on that. Whatever feed Marie was reading. Look, we can't keep going through a conversation like this and not mention Nottingham Forest. 3-0 winners last night, Liverpool next up. Like, what has Nuno Santo done there? What are the 17th in the league last year? Like, they beat Liverpool. Could they really be title challengers?
I think they can keep themselves in the conversation right away until the end of the campaign, and they're in that position that we've seen with teams in the past. We obviously saw it with Leicester a few years ago, where there's no League Cup, there's no European football. Depending on how they progress in the FA Cup, they'll be absolutely just Saturday and Sunday every week between now and the end of the season. I think they'll be right in the conversation for top four. And it's very hard to say, because you don't want to do them down, because they have been excellent this season. But generally speaking, the house, the big guys do win out in these types of situations. Top four, even top six for them, as you mentioned from last season, would be massive. I think it's 1995, 1996, the last time they qualified for European competition, so it would be huge. In terms of what they're doing differently, the basics have been massively ticked off. Defensively, they're really, really strong. You see when they get in front, even last night against Wolves away from home, they got in front and they never looked like they were going to lose. I know Wolves have not been great this season either, but I think that's such an underrated building block to work off. Murillo and Milenkovic at the back. Morgan Gibbs-White's a really creative force through the middle, and Chris Wood, unfashionable as he is, gets them goals. He gets kind of very, very typical number nine type goals. But sometimes that's what it takes. You don't need to win teams by battering them and winning in all the key metrics. You just need to win. And Nuno Santo is doing that, and they're on a huge wave of momentum. Liverpool will be a completely different question in their next Premier League game. But I think top six. I think they've done all the hard yards, so I think that's a big possibility.
I'd agree with Fergal there. I think top six would be a massive achievement. I don't see them getting top four. My worry for them would be if they were to lose one of the players that Fergal has just mentioned. Like, they don't score a huge amount of goals, just 29 in 20 games, which is quite a bit below some of the other teams around them. If something was to happen to a Chris Wood or a Morgan Gibbs-White, I'm not sure they have the strength and depth there to cover.
Let's hear from Nuno. He's speaking last night after his side beat Wolves.
Nuno, you did a great job at Wolves, and a lot of the time when we watched you play there, more often than not, it was a back three and you had huge success. Since you've come to Nottingham Forest, mainly you've played a back four. Is that anything to do with sort of the players that you had, or was it a different idea now that you've sort of been away from the game a few years?
I've not been away from the game. I've been
away from the Premier League, I think.
Premier League, sorry.
Okay. You never get away from the game, and that's the point that I mentioned. You start seeing how things change, and you have to adapt. And then it's about the players that you have, the squad available, and the idea.
Do you have any challenge, Nuno, on your hands? When all the fans are starting to get excited about what you're doing this season and they look at the league table, they see you right up there and they start thinking about Champions League football, do you have a challenge trying to focus your players on the job in hand?
Yeah, and we have the biggest challenge. Can we do it again? How well we did in the first round of the competition, can we do it again? This is the big challenge that we have, to sustain performance.
But largely with the same group of players, there have been a couple of changes. What do you look at as the time when it clicked for you? Was there something in a game? Was it in pre-season when you felt you had a chance this year of doing some exciting things with this team?
There's no specific time. You have big expectations, and then it's about the hard work of the players. Of course, the confidence in the first games of the season helps. If you want to determine exactly, I think when we finished the game against Burnley, we realized that we had a good group of players. We had more than that, the expectation of improvement for the next season. And then I think since we start working together and realizing that this is a teamwork, the spirit of the players among themselves, the support of the club on retaining the core of the squad, the important players that we had, then you start thinking, okay, it's we have a good foundation to work and to do things well.
He's done a great job, Paul, and there's a lot of comparisons being made now to Leicester and the points that they had on the table at this part of the season when they went on to win the Premier League, which was 40 points, which is what they are on the same time. So
yeah,
I know that Liverpool are ahead of them, and there's a lot, like, they think they won with 81 or something like that, but like, to go from that to top six is a bit...
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a fantastic achievement. I mean, the difference between the Forest situation and the Leicester situation is that when Leicester won the league, so many of the top four traditional teams were so off. I think Chelsea finished maybe eighth, and Liverpool finished, I think, in the bottom half that year, maybe the other way around. And, you know, it coincided with Leicester having a brilliant run of form that saw them winning the league. Like, you just don't see Liverpool or Arsenal in this vein of form, particularly Liverpool, how well they're going, dropping off their levels and coughing up enough points that would see Forest leapfrog them. But to the point on Nuno, like, his reputation was an absolute tatters after Tottenham. and how poorly it went for him after being such a success at Wolves. He obviously went off to Saudi Arabia before coming back to Nottingham Forest, and even when he went into Forest, there was a lot of Nottingham Forest fans who weren't happy to see the back of Cooper, who had gotten them promoted into the Premier League. So he's done a hell of a job. To think, you know, it wasn't too long ago we were talking about them being deducted points for PSR breaches and potentially being relegated, to now talking about them being in the top four, the top six of the Premier League. Is a serious achievement. And don't forget, Edu, who was at Arsenal, has now gone in as kind of the sporting director of, you know, the...
I had forgotten that, actually.
Over Marinakis' football group. And he would have a good eye, at least he did when he was at Arsenal, for bringing players in. So don't be surprised if that's a team there who look to strengthen in January.
They will, and they're going strong. Liverpool at home is their next game in the Premier League, but in fields further away in La Liga even. What about Vinicius Junior? Ancelotti believes he shouldn't have got sent off for slapping the Valencia goalkeeper. He says it was only a yellow. Surely if you hit someone, it's a red. Fergal?
From watching the game on Friday night, it's a nailed on red card. I was watching it and it kind of happened off the ball as it got cleared, and you know instantly it's going to be a red card. Again, it's the age old thing of, you raise your hands to someone's face, the goalkeeper does make a bit of a meal out of it, but he pushes him in the side of the face. You can't kind of make out that it was a shoulder or a push in the back or even a push in the chest. Sometimes when the ref runs over to the screen and sees maybe kind of a bit of pulling and shoving, they just let it go. You put your hands kind of shoulder up, it doesn't matter how much force you put on it, you're going to get sent off. I don't think it's any more than that. It's a very standard refereeing decision. He got sent off. It was a deserved red card. Real Madrid did brilliantly to come back into the game. They were 1-0 down at that point. Jude Bellingham getting a goal. I think it was 4th, 5th minute of added time. Luka Modric getting the equaliser. He's now broke Puskás' record. He's now the oldest player to play and score for Real Madrid. And that puts them back on top of the table over Atletico Madrid and Barcelona. So aside from the Vinicius red card, it was a really strong return for Carlo Ancelotti. But 2-game ban, he missed the Copa del Rey game yesterday, and he's going to miss the Super Cup game against Mallorca on Thursday unless the appeal gets passed. But I think that's probably unlikely, and Real Madrid will just cut their losses and say, yeah, we'll take the 2 games. Hopefully it doesn't get upgraded to more and just try and roll back into La Liga action when it starts the weekend after next.
Barcelona are playing Athletic Club tomorrow. Dani Olmo is in the squad. He's still ineligible, but there could be an appeal over the next little while. What's the latest on it, and what the hell's going on as well, Fergal?
So Barcelona have kind of done a bit of a show of strength towards La Liga and the Spanish Football Federation by naming him in the squad. They had a Copa del Rey game last week at the weekend as well, and he wasn't involved in that. They've now put him in the squad because they've got a final legal appeal today. From what I've been reading this afternoon, nothing has changed as it stands. So both he and Pau Victor are ineligible for every game for Barcelona. This is domestic games, cup games, probably the Champions League as well. Effectively, it kind of rests on this idea that Barcelona have been robbing from Peter to pay Paul in terms of their salary. So at the start of the season, they registered him because they had Andres Christensen and Ronald Araujo out injured. La Liga allow a bit of flexibility. If you've got a long-term injured player, they allow you to stretch your salary budget a little bit on the premise that when that player comes back fit, you've sorted out your finances enough that you're still within the parameters of their wage budget rules. Barcelona didn't do that. We saw with Ter Stegen when he got his bad knee injury, they brought in Szczesny, deregistered Ter Stegen. That was a bit more straightforward. They've tried all sorts of things to try and level it out. They've been selling new VIP boxes at the new camp for when that opens in 2025. They've had a couple more sponsorship deals rushed through, and they've kind of thrown all this paperwork at La Liga, and La Liga have said, well, you've missed the deadline, and we just kind of have... La Liga are effectively trying to make an example out of them because they've seen this happen over the last 3 or 4 years. Barcelona have made really poor financial decisions, and the other teams in the league have got very frustrated about it. And there's a little bit of small print in this, which is that technically the same player can't be registered more than once at the same team in the same season, as kind of bizarre and complex as that sounds. That is a rule in La Liga, and because he was only registered with them until the end of 2025, they would have to break their own rules and make a big exception to bring it back in. It's not quite dead and buried, but it really does look as if La Liga and the Spanish Federation are trying to make a point to Barcelona that they can't keep doing this and messing around with their finances, even if it means a really important player not being available for the rest of the season.
It all sounds like very creative accounting, which isn't working. But what about in Italy? Scott McTominay was on the score sheet for Napoli, and they've gone back top of the Serie A.
Yeah, they've been very, very impressive so far this season, and kind of getting a bit of the bite about them. Obviously, Antonio Conte himself, he's brilliant to watch. It's theatre on the sidelines. He's always full of energy and screaming and shouting and carrying on. I think Napoli are in a position where the chaos around the two Milan clubs, that they've not been at the level that they would have wanted this season, particularly AC Milan, they're benefiting from that. Scott McTominay is really making a name for himself in Italy. He's becoming a force in that Napoli midfield. Lukaku is scoring goals. Kvaratskhelia is out injured at the moment, but he's still a massive force for them as well. And the decision in the summer to loan out Victor Osimhen, it looked a bit of a risk at the start because he was such an important player for them, obviously back when they won the title and even since then scoring goals. But that seems to have changed a lot around the club and allowed Conte a bit more control over what he wants to do.
Paul, there's a couple of Carabao Cup semi-finals, first legs to take place over the next day or so. Arsenal and Newcastle tonight at 8 o'clock. How will both managers approach this, given the importance of silverware in any season?
Yeah, I think it's really important for both clubs, to be honest with you, Marie, particularly Arteta and the pressure that he's under when it comes to winning trophies. It seems that that's something that opposing fans seem to throw at that Arsenal team, that they've come so close, but they haven't managed to get over the line, particularly when it comes to the Premier League. So they will go full whack, I'd say, tonight, as will Newcastle. Newcastle are banging form, and there'll be no reason to kind of chop and change that team. They were super on the weekend again against Spurs. The energy that they have in the middle of the park, the physicality, and then obviously Isak at the top end of the pitch, who's gone so strong for them. So they've taken this competition very seriously in the last couple of years. They were knocked out by Chelsea, who went on to lose to Liverpool in the final. And the year before that, they were beaten by Manchester United after probably playing Erik ten Hag side on the day. So both teams, I would imagine, will go pretty close to full strength because of the importance of just building momentum off potentially winning a trophy.
Yeah, Fergal, it is important, isn't it? Because at the end of the season, when we're looking back on how managers did or didn't do, the fact that they won something, even if it is a Carabao Cup, is always a boost.
It's crucial, and Mikel Arteta is under pressure. He knows that the Premier League is the big focus because that's where Arsenal fans see themselves as challenging for a Premier League title again. But he's still just got one trophy, or one major trophy, the FA Cup that he won in his early days as Arsenal manager. Eddie Howe obviously has come close. They got beat by Manchester United in the Carabao Cup a couple of years ago. So this is really important for them as managers, just to ease a little bit of the pressure. Probably less relevant for Arsenal because, as I say, they're in that position where the fans want a title, whereas Newcastle, because it's been so long for them since winning a cup competition, they're in a different position where winning the Carabao Cup, winning the FA Cup would be enormous. And then looking on to tomorrow's games, Tottenham and Liverpool. Tottenham are in that basket with Newcastle as well. The fans are just dying for a trophy. And they're against the Liverpool side, who are just steamrolling everybody in front of them at the moment.
Always wins a trophy in a second season.
I hope. He's got a bigger fish to fry now, I think, at the moment. Thank you so much, Fergal Brennan. Appreciate it. Paul Carey, stay with us, because who knows what's going to happen in the next 20 minutes. It'd be always good to have you on hand. We're going to take a very quick break, but don't go anywhere, because we'll be talking rugby after these.
Game on. Check out the podcast on the RTE Radio Player app.
Now, welcome back. We are turning our attention to rugby. We will be speaking to RTE Sports, Neil Tracy, also presenter of the RTE Rugby podcast, in just a few minutes. But now we're going to hear from Leinster's Joe McCarthy. He spoke to Michael Corcoran a little bit earlier on.
Joe, it's this game against La Rochelle at the weekend, but it's kind of slightly unusual scenario for this time of the year. You haven't played a match for a while, but I suppose as players, you'd be happy that you've got to spend a bit more time on the training pitch together.
Yeah, no, definitely. So we had the Munster game, obviously, and then we got a rugby weekend, which is kind of rare in the season. So you can kind of spend a bit more time maybe looking over, reviewing games a bit more intensely, which we would have done, and then kind of embed some new things we want to implement over the next few weeks. So it's good little extra bit of preparation.
It's kind of slightly unusual, isn't it? You know, because it's normally match, rest, match, or whatever the way the season goes.
Yeah, you know, it was a bit kind of strange because usually we play on that kind of New Year's Day, but had New Year's off. But it's been good. We got a good game against Munster and then got a bit of time to rest and kind of refreshing up for the two Champions Cup games, which would be huge.
And they are huge, aren't they? I mean, starting with La Rochelle, a big bit of history between the two clubs over the years.
Yeah, exactly. We know them very well. They know us. So there's kind of that bit of rivalry when we play them, that extra bit of bite. So now we're looking forward to ripping into it. We've been prepping well and we love playing these big games.
What is it about them? I mean, as a club, as a unit, I mean, the rivalry has come pretty intense over the last couple of years. They win some, you win some. What makes them different, if you understand what I mean, from other sides?
Probably just because they've done well in Europe, beating us in a few big games, so stings a bit for us. So, and then when you play them, there's kind of knockout games. They're the games you want to win, so we're probably both going for the same kind of goal of winning Europe. So that just creates a bit of extra tension.
I know from conversations I've had with you in the past, whether it's with Ireland or with Leinster, when you play against a French team, it's up front decides everything, really, to be perfectly fair about it, whether it's a scrum or the line-out. I mean, you've got to bring a huge physicality.
Yeah, definitely. The scrum line-out's going to be definitely a big part of the game. They definitely pride themselves on trying to mess up your delivery at line-out and get after you in the scrum. But we have a lot of confidence in our scrum these days, how our line-out goes. So, we just need to make sure we turn up and be at our best because they'll be a tough side to get one over on that.
And we've certainly seen how increasingly more and more rugby is becoming a 23-man effort, really. I mean, Dan, that you're only as strong as the people who are on the bench.
Yeah, exactly. We talk a lot about this season, our bench being an impact, and we've huge quality across the team. The bench coming on adds something. It doesn't just fit in. So, it's huge. It's like to tire bodies to bring on. You see guys like Orgy and things like that coming on. It's great, and it really lifts the intensity at the end of the game.
When you mentioned Orgy, but you look at him and said Jordy Barrett and Slimani and the difference they make. I mean, they I would imagine, I'm not saying it took them a while, but they get why this competition is so important to Leinster.
Oh yeah, 100%. They bought into it, and I think they love these European weeks. They've only had about two of them now, obviously, in Leinster, but I think they love it because the build-up feels different in the building, the energy's a bit different, the focus is sharpened, so they've really bought into it and they love playing this competition.
In one respect, and I'm not comparing one with the other, but when you head to a place like Thomond Park, it's pretty intimidating there, to be fair about it. The game on Sunday, you're going to a kind of similar style atmosphere in terms of the crowd trying to get on your back. I mean, that surely brings out the best in you.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a similar kind of thing. They're very passionate about the rugby down in Munster. And then in La Rochelle, you see they're hugely well supported. So their fans will definitely be nice and rowdy at the ground. So I think they usually sell it out the whole time. So it's great. It's a great occasion to be a part of.
And just a final word, I mean, in terms of the way the competition has gone so far, you've played two, you've won two, but there's two massive games coming up over the next two weekends.
Yeah, it's class. So La Rochelle, we obviously know they've won Europe twice over the last few years, and then Bath, who are leading the Premiership, and they're playing extremely well. So it's exactly the test we want to be in. We want to see where we're at as a squad and try and win those games, try and dominate as much as we can.
And just a final word just about referees and refereeing. Discipline is something that people talk about all the time, but it's becoming increasingly more important. I don't mean you personally, I mean just as a squad.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's you see the rules seem to change like every week now, so you almost have to need a little lesson on the laws every week as a player. So yeah, we'll keep trying to it's something you always have to look at, because especially a team like La Rochelle, if you give them access into your 22, it's tough to keep them out. If you keep giving them access, they'll probably eventually get points or a bit more pressure on you. So yeah, it's something we'll look at, and we'll obviously try and reduce as many penalties as you can and try and force pressure on them to get penalties ourselves.
So that's Joe McCarthy speaking ahead of Leinster's huge game against La Rochelle this weekend. I'm delighted to say that Neil Tracy joins us now on the line. Neil, it is a big weekend for rugby. We've been looking for one to come along, and here's one now. What are you looking forward to most?
Hi Marie, how are you doing? I think Leinster La Rochelle really just is the game of the weekend.
Great, you've said it now. Okay, that's the game of the weekend.
Yeah, and look, no disrespect to a game like Munster and Saracens, which is an absolute cracker as well, like at Thomond Park, two big old rivals as well. But there has been something about La Rochelle and Leinster over these last few years, particularly now that Leinster have actually kind of come back into the rivalry over the last 13 months or so, that they've won two in a row against La Rochelle, having lost, what, two finals on the spin and a semi-final before that as well. And, you know, Ronan O'Gara has always had a little bit of a plan for Leinster, up until last season, I should say. And, you know, the way they went to the Aviva Stadium last year, having had a long trip to South Africa the previous week, O'Gara wasn't really happy with the scheduling of that. He wasn't happy with how his team rocked up to Dublin that week as well. So I would be expecting a full-blooded game between the two as well, particularly after La Rochelle. I mean, they beat Toulouse at the weekend. What a way to warm yourself up for a game against Leinster. But like, this just has been probably the best rivalry of the Champions Cup in the last 3 or 4 years, and I'm including Leinster against Toulouse in that as well, because that was a fairly one-sided rivalry up until Toulouse beat Leinster in the final just gone.
No, Neil, I was laughing at Joe McCarthy saying that the La Rochelle usually sell out their home venue. They've actually sold it out for 100 games on the trot. It's not nothing usual about it. It will be some atmosphere.
It will be. I've never been to a game at La Rochelle, but I was there last the summer of 2023. It was the weekend that they were in the top 14 final in Paris. And I sat out on the old port in La Rochelle, one of about 15,000 people watching the game on a big screen. And I think it's fair to say the people in that town absolutely love their rugby. It is a rugby town. I'd say it's a bucket list venue for the majority of rugby fans to go there sometime to see a game. I know it's certainly on my one as well. And, you know, Leinster, they dealt with that atmosphere brilliantly last December when they went over there in what was probably a tough game to watch. I remember it was a pouring rain game last December in the opening round of the Champions Cup. And Kieran Frawley and Harry Byrne both put in excellent displays at out half, and Leinster basically just ground out a win where there was scuffles and skirmishes and off the ball stuff. And I remember James Ryan was getting on the wrong side of the referee Matthew Carley that afternoon as well, and was being warned. And, you know, Matthew Carley was at once, it was back when Leinster were doing their dual captains of Gary Ringrose and James Ryan, and the referee just wasn't even listening to James Ryan at a certain point. So there's a great edge to it as well, and it's something that Leinster do have to be wary of, just kind of dealing with that crowd. I know, as Michael Corcoran and Joe McCarthy were saying, they had a nice way to warm up for it as well down in Thomond Park a couple of weeks ago on the 27th of December, where I was there was a brilliant atmosphere that night as well, and Leinster dealt with it excellently.
There was a Connacht press conference today. Pete Wilkins was speaking to the media. Neil, you were at it, and he had a bit of an update on the Mack Hansen hearing and also on Mark Sexton's exit.
Yes, so I mean, like, the Mack Hansen hearing is set for tomorrow after his comments, which feel like a lifetime ago now. They were, what, the 21st of December after their defeat to Leinster at the Aviva Stadium. There probably isn't even a huge amount left to kind of say on that. I think over the last two and a half weeks, most people have had their say on it and on what it is. And I think now we're just, like, I think we're all assuming there will be some form of a sanction, and we just kind of have to wait and see what that is going to be. The Mark Sexton story is interesting enough for people who don't know. He's the Connacht attack and backs coach, younger brother to Johnny Sexton, and a highly rated coach as well, who was part of that Ireland under-20s coaching team that won two Grand Slams in 2022 and 2023. And he's going to be leaving at the end of the season. It was confirmed today. It looks like most likely that he's joining Ulster. Nothing is confirmed on that, but that seems to be what the speculation is saying, where he'll be linking back up with Richie Murphy, who he worked under with the Ireland under-20s a couple of years ago. And, like, it really is a frustrating blow for Connacht, because they've got in a rut now where they've developed coaching teams over years and are consistently losing some of that good coaching talent to other teams, and not just teams abroad, but teams within Ireland as well. Like, 2 years ago, they lost Mossy Lawler, their backs coach, who Mark Sexton replaced. They lost him to Munster. There's speculation as well that their scrum coach, Colly Tucker, could also be joining Munster. You know, this is the second year of what is a relatively new coaching team that were just finding their feet, and, you know, all of a sudden now they have to go back to the market and try fill out that role. So it's a very frustrating time for them, and, you know, for a team that are always kind of operating on a tight budget, tighter than the other provinces, I would say. They they generally have a good track record of producing good coaches, but they're, I suppose, being frustrated that those coaches are only lasting a few seasons before being snapped up by someone else.
Neil, we are a little bit tight on time, but just going back to Mack Hansen, will it be his language that he's in trouble for? Because listening to what he said, he didn't say anything else that was wrong.
Yeah, look, I just think there is just a general precedent there where particularly I think there have been a couple of incidences in England in the last couple of years around the Premiership where a couple of high-profile England internationals have criticised refereeing displays or probably the used language, I suppose, along the lines of what Hansen would have said back in December, and they have picked up relatively small bans. I wouldn't be expecting him to get a particularly large ban, but I think, to be honest, you probably are looking at some sort of a sanction, which we'll find out about in the next couple of days.
Well, if I was him, I'd be going in and standing my ground anyway. Neil Tracy, thanks a million. Cheers to you, Paul Curry, and to you, Marie Crowe. That's all we have time for this afternoon. Game On is back again tomorrow evening.